Today in Unsolved Mysteries, we take a look at iFolder. We're also going to cover some news from support, right now on Novell Open Audio. Welcome to Novell Open Audio, the podcast that connects the Novell user community with what's going on inside and around the Novell universe. I'm your host, Ted Hager, and there is, once again, no Aaron Quill today because he's in France. I don't know. It's just where he is. We're going to cover a couple cool things, though, today. We're going to get into iFolder as our first interview, and we're talking to Jason Williams, who's the product manager for Open Enterprise Server and has good news for us about iFolder. What's happened to it? Where it's been? A lot of people have asked us what's going on with it. In fact, we had a listener named David Harrison from New Zealand who actually wrote a review about Novell Open Audio that I blogged about not too long ago. And one of his things was, what happened to iFolder? Why haven't we been told about it? It's gone quiet. The wiki hasn't been updated. So we get to a listener question, not from David Harrison, but from somebody else, that's going to introduce us to what's happened with iFolder. Then we got Dave Mayer coming back in, and he's going to give us news from support. Oh yeah, we got one other thing to mention. We did an episode not too long ago about GCC, the new compiler collection, and how Novell's contributing into that. And we opened the show with a teaser where we asked, who is that? Why is it relevant to the show? And John Strickland was the guy that actually came up with that answer. John Strickland out of Raleigh, North Carolina. Good work. He mentioned that it was Jeff Jaffe who made the quote, and it was relevant because we were talking about pure upstream contribution at that point. So, John, congratulations on winning the shirt. We'll have that out to you shortly. Let's check out the iFolder interview. By popular listener request, it's time to find out what happened to iFolder. iFolder 3 went open source a while back. We had a team of people working on it. We had a wiki site set up. All of this kind of stuff still exists. But a lot of our listeners got the idea that iFolder, for some reason, got divested by Novell, and it wasn't moving forward. In fact, our first question for our product manager, Jason Williams, who joins us here in the studio today, comes from Vince Kimball, and he asks this, and this is from an actual email to our Open Audio Novell account, Jason. He said, so what's going on with iFolder? The development schedule disappeared from the wiki. The daily builds for Mac or for Windows or Mac 3.4 clients have not been built in a long time. And there doesn't seem to be much development activity, judging by comments on the project's Subversion repository. Is the project dead?
What happened to iFolder? So what happened to iFolder is this. It wasn't really going where Novell wanted it to go, and it wasn't really going where our customers wanted it to go. iFolder is a great technology. I use it constantly. iFolder has saved my life and the life, well, working life and the lives of others on numerous occasions through hard disk crashes or being unable to access things through just broken, stolen laptops and stuff. So Novell really had a moment of introspection. In other words, what do we actually want iFolder to do in the future? It did some great things, you know, the whole Delta Sync, the whole you don't have to retrain your users the way it worked, the ability to share iFolders, getting clients onto Linux and Mac and things like that. But realistically, there were still some things we wanted to do with it, and we just weren't sure where to go. So we actually took the time to go work that out. We decided that the best thing to do was to temporarily offline the project and have a good, hard look at where iFolder needs to go. So what's happening? Because that's the big question, isn't it? iFolder has not gone away. In fact, iFolder 3.6 is going to be shipping with OES2.
So Novell is actually committed to iFolder, and Novell is engineering iFolder still.
I can tell you right now, there is a full engineering team actively developing iFolder today. There will be a release of iFolder 3.6 that's going to ship with OES2. And in fact, right now, myself and others have been talking to a lot of people over the last few months, and we now have a solid plan for what iFolder next, in other words, what happens beyond 3.6, is actually going to look like. So not only do we have the next release plan for OES2, but we even have the really good, solid idea of exactly what the next major release of iFolder following 3.6 is going to be. I'm not talking about that one today, because that's a whole other discussion, and that's what we're going to be highlighting at BrainShare 2. So what I will do is talk about what the real short-term plans for iFolder are going to be for next year.
Good. Let's get into what these next features are going to be. But first, I want to ask a couple other questions about the project iFolder as opposed to the product iFolder. Because the project iFolder, the open source project, when Novell brought it out as an open source mono project, has been picked up by other distributions and is now available on Debian. I think it's a component of Ubuntu at this point. And because of that, there are a lot of people in the Linux community who now look to this and were very, very much, I think, nervous that Novell had walked away from it, and are still going to be nervous if it's not still open source. So does it remain in open source?
Let's be clear. Once you open source something, once you GPL it, that's it. It's open sourced. So I know that, you know, I haven't gone onto the wiki site. I haven't posted any comments there as yet. I haven't said anything, and that's simply because of the fact I've actually been really hard at work trying to get OES2 shipped and also get iFolder built.
iFolder's like one little component among your gigantic burden with open enterprise.
Absolutely.
Server.
When you're driving several hundred million lines of code written by, you know, hundreds of engineers, yeah, it's a real big responsibility. So the next thing I need to do is we need to get back out onto that wiki site and explain exactly what's going on. And I will be undertaking to do that within the next 2 to 3 weeks and give a full detailed account of what we're going to do. iFolder, the project, won't be pulled.
You're correct. Once it's in GPL, of course, that's going to have contributions back. Any other development that we do, we're bound by the GPL to continue to put that out there.
That's right.
But the process has, of course, changed. People have noticed, certainly Vince Kimball has noticed, that the daily builds aren't happening. Are we going to get back to a point where there are regular checkpoint builds that are being put up on the network or on Subversion or anything like that?
That's what we hope to achieve. At the moment, what I can tell you is this, is the engineering team is working hard on producing iFolder 3.6 for OES2. So that is my primary concern. And I know that the community is probably going to turn around and go, well, you know, we'd like to see the daily builds back and stuff. We'll get to that, absolutely. What I need to do is we need to get our engineering resources actually lined up so we're doing the right things. Ultimately, the way I look at iFolder is this. It is a wonderful technology from Novell that people absolutely love. I mean, I've talked to so many people about iFolder. I like it. I've been the product manager for it for a while now, so I fully appreciate how people feel about it. But I want to do the right thing by iFolder. And the right thing by iFolder is really a dual approach, is ensuring that I've got customers that buy OES that use iFolder. I have to do the right thing by them. And then I've got the community project that's iFolder, and I have to do right by the community. Sometimes servicing those two masters is pretty hard, so I need to get this lined up so I do the right thing for both. Not an easy thing to do, but I want to do the right thing. Sometimes that means by doing the right thing, you kind of have to go dark for a little while to work it out. Hopefully, this Novell Open Audio interview will actually shed some light into the dark places that people felt that iFolder was dropping into and sort of say, no, it's coming back. And not only is it coming back, but it's coming back very, very strong.
Okay.
And they'll like where we're going with this.
We can say to people at that point then that, hey, sorry for the interrupt on the public site and about the information and stuff. With this interview, we're attempting to start shedding light back on what's going on with iFolder.
Absolutely.
And with that, then, 3.6.
3.6.
Gimme, what do we get?
Well, you get a whole load of stuff. So where can we start from? First thing, let's take some of the things that we had gripes about initially with the initial release of iFolder. One of the things we got was this. Okay, so you've got this whole iFolder system, but it's limited to a single server. So we can't scale it. Well, you got multi-server support. And by the way, there's no limit to the number of servers you can actually have in an iFolder system with 3.6. So if you wanted 10 servers, fine. 20, go ahead. 50, fine. 250, 1,000, doesn't matter. All those servers can support a single iFolder system. We also got another thing. I want multiple domains inside my iFolder. So I may be running more than one company. I want to support multiple iFolder domains. You can do that too. So now you can support multiple iFolder domains with multiple servers servicing all of those domains.
So your servers can actually become like a server pool or a server farm of iFolder servers that work together, but you could have your public one that you offer maybe as an internet service to certain constituents of yours, like partners or customers or something, plus you could have your internal ones and they could be pointing to two different domains.
That's exactly right, Ted. That's precisely what we're going to be doing. So that was a couple of things that we got complaints about, was make it more scalable. Another thing we got about was, When it came to authentication and authorization, and I'm not talking about the storing of the iFolder objects in a directory, but people have got multiple different authentication directories, Open LDAP, Active Directory, eDirectory, Sun1. So we're now going to allow any and all of those LDAP directories to act as the authentication source to get access to iFolder.
So the Ubuntu geek out there who says, you know, hey, I like eDirectory. My friend George Castro actually said this to me not too long ago. He said, man, I wish you guys would open source eDirectory, but until you do, I'm going to continue working with Red Hat's directory. And it's because he's cheap and doesn't want to pay anything. No,
I can't wait to meet this guy.
George is great. The thing he's said is because of that, he's using Red Hat's directory service. So he'd be able to actually on his Ubuntu server run Red Hat's directory and iFolder, and this would all theoretically come together and work well.
Now remember, it's for authorization authentication. So you still have to have an eDirectory server right now to actually store all the iFolder objects and things like that. But yeah, those people that actually have things like Sun1 and have, you know, because we know there are people out there that use millions of objects in eDirectory. We also appreciate there are people that already have a policy in place that states, I use this directory to do all my authorization. All your authorization can be done through any one of those directories. So that's a big change as well. Some of the other things we're doing is this, server-side trash can. That's new.
Oh, you mean so now if I delete files locally, they get deleted on the server. I won't have them on my second machine, like my machine at home. I won't be able to recover from there. But if I go onto the web client, I could recover things?
Absolutely. Just like salvage, man. Just like salvage.
Very cool.
Absolutely. We got a lot of people saying, if somebody deletes a file by accident in a shared iFolder, it's toast. Yeah. Well, no longer. You just log into the web client, look at that iFolder. There it is, server-side trash can. You can recover that file.
Does it have to be a specific back-end volume for that to work? Does it have to be like on an NSS volume?
Nope. You can be any volume you want to put it on. EXT3, NSS, Riser, XFS, JFS, FAT. Yeah, right.
Okay. Well, that's pretty cool. What else you got?
Well, the new client, the 3.6 client, we've actually gone back in, done some significant performance improvements. So when you're actually transferring data across the wire from a server to the client or a client to the server, huge performance improvements. So we really have scaled that up no end.
That's good. One of the complaints I've heard from people is that because iFolder client was written on Mono, they feel like Mono is costing a tax on the client side. Is it still on Mono, and is that conjecture even fair to say that Mono is what's causing slowness in iFolder?
So I'm going to say that I don't know a huge amount about the Mono project. What I have seen is the fact that I'm not convinced that Mono in and of itself does attacks like that. And that's not what I've seen. What we have done is this. Part of what made iFolder 3 client a lot slower was the fact that we actually did the entire transport mechanism through HTTPS. Well, of course, when you're doing secure HTTP, you have attacks just by running it that secure.
Yeah,
it slows things down. So what we're doing is this. The crypto is now done at the client, and the client files are encrypted before they leave the client. They're then transmitted over HTTP, and then the user's public-private key is used to decrypt the files and write them to the file system at the server.
So it's architected the right way now.
Absolutely.
But the question then becomes, you got your new server and your old clients. Can the old 3.4 clients still talk to the 3.6 server?
So the 3.4 clients will be able to talk to a 3.6 server. However, we will strongly advise everyone to upgrade to a 3.6 client.
This is a quick audio patch because we found out that we had a fact wrong on this one. It turns out that the 3.4 client will not work well with the 3.6 server. You have to have the 3.6 client. One nice thing, though, is the 3.6 client will still migrate all your data forward, meaning which folders you have synchronized to the iFolder server and stuff. You don't have to reassign all the folders and stuff. It'll migrate all that data. So it'll upgrade automatically. You just have to have the 3.6 client attached to the 3.6 server. And now back to your regularly scheduled interview.
Now, great thing about moving to 3.6 is the fact that we have a 3.2 3.4 to 3.6 migration tool that simply converts the iFolder data store at the server, and bingo, you're using 3.6 clients directly against it.
Is that freely available?
That will be freely available, absolutely. That migration tool will probably come a little bit after, a couple of weeks after we initially ship iFolder 3.6, so people start getting used to it, and then we'll ship the migration tool.
So in other words, don't upgrade your systems, your 3.4 systems to 3.6. Just
not right away.
Pilot the code, test the code on 3.6, and that utility will follow shortly
after.
That's
right. And what we wanted to do is we wanted to get the 3.6 server code in the hands of people right away. Stuff like, you know, the server-side migration tools, they can easily be come later on and they just run against the data store and up you go. But we wanted to get the 3.6 code into our customers' hands at OES ship time. We've also made changes to the client to make sharing a lot easier. Sharing an iFolder was always pretty good, but you know something, it left some little bit to be
first
desired.
First rev interfaces tend to have user mystery to them for some reason. They don't necessarily work out.
Yeah, just a little bit. And to be honest with you, we kind of listen to people we shouldn't have listened to sometimes. We all do the same thing. So we went back and
in the 3.4 version,
in the 3.4 version.
Not in the upcoming
version.
That's
right. So what we decided to do is we took that and went right back to first principles and said, what's going to be easy to do this? So we've made that a lot easier. On the client side, we're going to have support for Windows 2000, Windows XP. Windows Vista client is coming up. Oh, and hey, look at this. Just especially for you, sir, we're going to be doing PowerPC and Intel Mac client updates as well, and done properly this time.
Mike, the audio guy, smiles, nods his head.
Absolutely. Happiness oh, and by the way, delivered. If you'd like it, we'll even do you a dual binary.
When you say a dual binary, that's...
Sorry, for those people that use Mac OS will know what this is. A dual binary. So Mac
there's
OS
the Intel
now has
version of Mac, and then there's
the
PowerPC version.
So a dual
Mac.
Binary is a single disk image and a single application that when it runs will detect whether it's running on an Intel or PowerPC Mac and actually start in the Intel or PowerPC version of the app automatically. So a single app that runs on either platform.
Now, there will be some people that go, but that's going to take up more disk space.
Yeah,
the
well, it doesn't take up
nice,
that.
Though, right?
Convenience is really good. If you take a look at GroupWise Messenger, GroupWise Messenger is a dual binary that actually runs quite happily on PowerPC or Intel.
That's all pretty cool stuff.
Yeah.
Before I move on, though, is that it? Is that the whole list?
That isn't the whole list. We've actually got a vastly improved web interface. A lot of it's actually been built using Web 2.0 technology. So that actually runs really, really, really good. I mean, I've been looking at some of the new code we're running there, and it is really very, very slick.
Web 2.0 technology, let's get a little more specific than that because, you know, it's pretty much, you know, everybody's calling stuff Web 2.0. Are you meaning it's Ajax built?
This is going to be things like using Ajax, Ruby, Rails, that kind of thing. It's all open standards, though. So we're not actually going to be going out and doing anything proprietary. Again, the whole thing runs in Apache.
And so it becomes tweakable as well. If somebody wants to customize even the code itself, somebody could get in there and make mods to
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. That's what we're aiming for. However, taking a look at the new web client, I don't think anyone will need to mod it. The new web client is quicker, easier to access, simpler to understand, has better browser support.
Is the code actually starting to work yet?
The code is actually starting to work right now. We've had builds coming in. It will be there for the private beta of OES 2 coming out in January, early February next year, so people can start, you know, getting access to it. So we are there. The code is working. So we're going great guns on this right now. The engineering team has done a great job.
Is there any way that we can get maybe some you to blog some preliminary screenshots or anything like that for people that really got to see this now?
I've got Uma to send me some screenshots over of the new web client. So I was going to blog that and put a couple of screenshots in and also the new 3.6 Windows client as well. So I will do that as soon as I'm back from sales conference.
Very cool. Well, let's hit a couple listener questions and wrap this up. I think you know this listener. It's our friend John Strickland again.
Hey, John, what's up?
All right. So his question is, since iFolder Enterprise Server has now been open sourced, can you explain your role regarding that? Because open source projects, you know, we don't think of how always having a project or a product manager, excuse me, on them, especially a smaller open source project. But iFolder's not, its impact is huge, but it's not a gigantic project, not like a Linux kernel or something like that. What does a product manager like you do in an open source project?
Well, you know, to be honest with you, it'd be some people that say that as the product manager, I sit in my office, stare out the window, and draw a paycheck and go home at the end of the day.
That's got to be nice.
It has, actually. Unfortunately, that's not me. So what do I actually do? iFolder as an open source project clearly has a lot of people contributing to the project and pushing it in the direction they feel it needs to go and want to do. iFolder as a product is a very different thing. After all, I have hundreds of thousands, millions of users. I have firms, small and large, that use this, and they have specific requirements. Not all of those requirements can either be met or are desirable to an open source project. So what I have to do is, as a product manager, I have to, and this is part of how the iFolder project went dark, is I have to work out what is it we need to do to make iFolder as a product successful so iFolder as a project can continue. Because the two are a little bit different. iFolder as a product is something that my customers pay me for support. They pay me because they want to...
They fund the project,
essentially. They fund the project because they're paying Novell to support that product for them. Ergo, what I have to go out to do is find out what these guys actually need to allow me to fund the project. Well, that's what I do as product manager. I'm not the only product manager that works on iFolder. I should point that out right now. From an OES point of view, that's what we've been doing. We went a little bit dark is because we had to actually resolve that. Again, when you take a look at the mixture of open source versus proprietary, that's where the actual you have to draw those demarcation lines is where does the product end and the project begin.
All right. And we have one last question for you, and this comes from our friend Mike Brady.
Hey, Mike
asks, I'd like to know if or when there will be updated documentation on iFolder 3. I recently had trouble with my iFolder server and had to reinstall. I tried to follow the docs on how to restore, but I had zero luck. So apparently there's not enough documentation on it. Is that in the priority queue for Open Enterprise Server?
Absolutely. In fact, there is our full documentation team is targeted against revamping and rewriting the documentation for iFolder 3.6. So we're going to have a full documentation suite for the 3.6 product out there. The open source project will be able to leverage a lot of that because it will be very common. When it comes to actually, he's made an interesting point about backup and restore because we've had some issues with backup and restore on iFolder 3 in the past. We're moving around that. We're reintroducing encryption, but we're actually making the backup and restore process work a lot easier. So you can use your existing backup and restore tools to backup an iFolder system and restore it easily, right down to a single file.
So there'll be some kind of agent that you have to make then so that something like a Veritas or whatever can talk to it?
We're working towards the fact that our backup vendors won't have to make any changes. They'll simply be able to back it up, back up the files, and restore the files. And they won't have to do anything to make it work. That's a tough thing to do, but that's exactly what we're aiming for.
Wow, that sounds like it's ambitious.
It's ambitious, but you know something? We've got it working.
Very nice. Well, Jason, thanks very much for giving us an update on iFolder. I guess it's
anytime.
Safe to say iFolder is alive and well.
Absolutely. iFolder is alive and well.
Great features on the way. I love the idea that I'm going to be able to hit the web client and restore things that I blew up on another machine.
Well, you know something? When you take a look at salvage on NSS and how many people love that, it absolutely made sense to add it into iFolder.
Great. Thanks a lot, okay. Jason.
Anytime, Ted.
Our three tough questions were submitted by listeners from our audience, and they are going to be receiving the I Ask Tough Questions Novell Open Audio coveted t-shirt. It's coming up to you guys in the mail shortly. And that was Vince Kimball, Mike Brady, and again with the John Strickland. This guy just keeps coming up. And with that, Jason Williams is actually trying to get a blog post going where he's going to put up some of the pictures of what the iFolder screens are looking like at this point. Don't know when he's going to have them online because he's in France. Everybody's in France right now. But anyway, what we're going to do is we will have some pictures. We will link to them from this episode at some point. Or you can follow Jason's blog at novell.com/coolblogs and just click on Jason Williams' name in the right-hand navigation. Moving on, let's check out news from support. And I did this interview while Aaron Quill was still in town. This was on October 31st. So you will hear Aaron's voice on this one, almost as though he were really here. Well, Aaron, guess what?
It's time for news from support.
News from support, indeed.
About time, too.
Bring in the Scotsman. Dave, how are you?
Good. How about you guys?
Excellent.
Yeah, nice.
Now
to...
that I'm here, you're smiling.
Now, you look lonely here. What's the deal? Where's our friend Randy?
Randy's on vacation this week. He'll be back for the next one. But I got a few things that I can cover for him. He'll be okay.
This has been my thing. I've been saying, do not allow people to go on vacation. It slows down productivity. But anyway, so what do we got this week?
Somebody's got to do his work for him.
Are you doing his work? Do you have the cool tip of the week?
I do, in fact. There's a bunch of security notifications and TIDs this
Security
week.
Notifications. So this is one that's important for us to say that we will have these linked from this episode's notes. So remember to check back on the website for the links to each of these things that Dave's going to talk about. Ooh, security.
Absolutely. The one that I think is most important is a security update for OpenSSH, and that applies to pretty much every Linux version. It's released by us as patch number 11248. You'll get full details in the link that'll be on the website with the podcast, but that's a big one for me.
An SSH security hole, you said?
That is correct.
Okay, so let me ask about that real quick, though. We've actually been telling people to use SSH. It's more secure than a lot of other types of things. What kind of compromise is possible with this?
There's not actually a lot of detail on this. There's a denial of service problem, and it could be used if lots of CPU consumption happens on a remote OpenSSH server. There's one that can be used to inject network traffic, but there's nothing too major from my point of view in these. These are worth patching as a routine thing.
So it's not going to necessarily compromise data. It's more that it's going to compromise service.
That is correct. And you're not looking at a case where there are going to be attacks in the field happening right away on any of these.
And one important thing, since this is for SUSE Linux, as long as I'm registered with Novell Customer Center, I automatically get this and all the other security updates that you're going to mention, right?
Absolutely.
In fact, I think that I got this SSH update at the end of last week.
And SSH is such a wonderful thing, it's worth patching these. There's a bunch of patches for eDirectory 8.8.1 and earlier. The patch is eDirectory 8.8.1 FTF. And there may be newer versions by the time you read this. I think there's
FTF is field test file, right?
I believe so, yes.
We have to watch out for that kind of acronym right there because in different circles it means different things.
I get one of those for you later.
Let's go into the details on that patch because I want to talk about when you apply a patch versus a service pack.
This one's really confusing. The patches come between service packs, but there's also patches and updates. Patches happen to service packs, but updates are kind of freeform. And a lot of the time, we don't recommend doing the updates, just the patches.
So I only do an update if it's something that's relevant to a problem that I'm having, right?
If it's something you want, I would do the updates. But if it's something that's a patch, it's probably something you need if it's a patch to something you have installed. Those tend to be released between the service packs. The big releases, the service packs, include all of the patches up to that point, unless there's some specific reason not to include one.
And with something like a field test file, an FTF, you can actually have one FTF have an update that another FTF doesn't have. So there could actually be two FTFs to the same thing for patching two different problems. By the time you get a service pack, those are consolidated, and that's why you want to go with the service pack, unless the field test addresses a problem that you know you are having, right?
Absolutely. And we have another thing in the SUSE Linux software where we do program temporary fixes, PTFs, and where we have a customer report a problem that's obviously a bug, we have the bug fixed, and that customer gets a program temporary fix just for their problem. That then rolls into a service pack later, and when the customer does their next update, either a patch or a service pack, then that update should be available for them. But there's a little bit of coordination required with those. It's always worth checking the change logs in these things when they're released and checking to see if something you expect to be there, something you've had as an interim patch, really is there. There are four security vulnerabilities named against eDirectory 8.8.1, and those are all patched with this 8.8.1 FTF, and I'll provide the link to that, and we'll have it on the website. And Qt3, this is one of those wonderful things where you see a lot written about Linux projects, but you never really know how to say them. I'm pretty sure this one is Qt. It's a library for user interface components.
This is what makes KDE come to life. KDE is written to Qt, so most of the interface of KDE, the framework pieces, all the chunks that it takes in to make an interface, it's written to Qt.
That's right. And there are a bunch of overflows, arithmetic overflows, and they can cause heap overflows and code execution that shouldn't be. These are all patched. Again, there's a number of them. I see four again in this list, and the links will be provided on the website again. But these are the critical things. So OpenSSH, eDirectory, and Qt, those all need to be patched, and we'll provide that.
And the really cool thing is the eDirectory one is not one that you'll see through the Customer Center type updates, but if you're registered with the Customer Center for the SSH or the Qt ones, you've probably already seen these updates. Now you've heard a little bit about them, and we'll link to the TIDs to explain more.
Well, the OpenSSH one was published today, I think, but in general that's true. As soon as these things become available, then they'll be in the patch channels. And if you're doing regular updating of your host, then yes, you'll have these already most likely. Some of the things like OES, the eDirectory ones, are in the channel as well. So you may get those without needing to monitor this. But nevertheless, these have been announced. It's worth verifying that you'd have these patches by name. The rest is just a bunch of general TIDs plus this little I guess, cool solution that I have. Whitebox PC Makers pre-install Novell SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop. So basically, we got a bunch of vendors of Whitebox PCs who are now shipping SUSE Linux.
And this has actually been a big push worldwide. I know when I was still working on Novell Linux Desktop 9, Intel was actually doing quite a few events with white box vendors to get them building Linux boxes, not just in European and North American countries, but actually in a lot of the countries like actually the Southeast Asian countries and things like that. So this is actually something that's been picking up over quite a bit of time.
It's a great thing because now you can go to a manufacturer and get an integrated solution. You're not paying the tax that we all know of that comes with buying the box, and you're not left with having to destroy the configuration that's on it and rebuild from scratch. You're getting something shipped to you that has a pre-built, organized Linux installation, and you're getting it for one price.
With drivers already set up, installed, and working.
Life is good.
Excellent.
So these are great. The only problem there that I saw is if you want a blue box PC, then that's not going to be much good to you from white box manufacturers. There's another kind of silly one that I found, how to surpress SURPRESS output from JBoss console. Somebody who wrote up this TID didn't run it through a spell checker. So how to surpress output from JBoss console. If you wrote that TID, I think there's got to be a t-shirt in it for that one. So please get in touch.
Claim it by sending us your claim, however you want to prove it. openaudio@novell.com.
And we also have the email address for Randy and myself. You can get in touch with us on, what's the email address for that one, Ted?
You mean for Ask Randy and Dave?
That's it's the one.
newsfromsupport@novell.com. And you can, if you want Dave and Randy to cover anything on the show, or you want them to hit a special tip on Linux, these guys will do it. Remember, newsfromsupport does the Ask Randy and Dave segment. But we haven't gotten our first one yet because actually we just went live with that episode from the time we're recording this only a week ago. So nobody's called it in yet, but we're waiting. We're waiting on the first one.
And I guess we should say that we're actually recording this one on Halloween, October 31st, 2006. So moving on, SDB, the OpenSUSE database, publishes a lot of great articles. Disabling IPv6 completely. I looked at it in the word completely. It just implied to me, you know, we
total
just want to get this off of there.
Scorched
like,
earth.
Get this thing off my box. IPv6, it's a wonderful idea, but I don't know how it's going to take off. It's been around for a long time, but IPv4 is entrenched, and there are solutions that make the address space manageable. I don't know where IPv6 is going to go, but I'd like to see it take off. I'd like to have multiple statically assigned IP addresses owned by me, but I just don't see it happening anytime soon.
So why would I want to turn off IPv6?
You know, that's a really good question. It's not widely used, and can be disabled. It slows down IPv4 TCP IP connections. Disabling it then is pretty easy, so you can always undo the changes.
So it's got overhead to it when you have it there?
One stack, I guess, and I'd like to know who really is able to notice that their IPv4 connections are slower because they have IP6 enabled. It's got to be server applications doing heavy transaction loads. It can't be the average user.
Yeah, you'd think it would be the Gentoo people, you'd think, would be very much into making sure that that's not there, just because every little bit of optimization, you know, that's why you use a self-compiling distro or something. But other than that, it's if it's not that much overhead, it's...
Exactly. I see this a lot, in particularly with regard to virtual machine configurations. People asking, should I put my virtual machine configuration on a different disk from my operating system that's hosting that virtual machine? Why care? Unless you're running applications that are going to cause disk saturation, you're not going to be able to tell the difference. And most people who are using virtual machines, most people who are using IP, are not going to be able to tell the difference between these things being optimized or not optimized. The differences are just too small.
If you're one of those people that is into the elegance of how you've implemented something and the optimization elegance of it, this TID is for you, and we'll link to it.
Absolutely. It's a Zen thing, really, isn't it? So EVMS command line cannot handle server names that begin with a number. This one relates to EVMS GUI not having a limitation. You can't have server names.
What's EVMS?
Enterprise Volume Manager, service or system. I think it's service. But the command line version of it and the GUI version of it have different behavior in this regard. If you have a server name that begins with a number, like 2B, and you'd rather server not 2B, this is not going to let you manage it by EVMS with the command line. The workaround is to use EVMS GUI, even though the resolution documented in this TID is to change the server name. I would think anybody would prefer to use a different tool than to change a server name just to avoid this problem.
Yeah, especially if that's going to disrupt people connecting to it, like if it messes up a Samba name or anything like that. So EVMS is a SUSE feature, right? It's something accessible through YAST?
That is correct, yes.
And therefore, it would also affect Open Enterprise servers running on Linux.
What EVMS does anyway is let you have more strategic volume management, storage management, higher level storage management. It permits features like clustering, makes it easier to manage clustering. In fact, Novell's cluster services, the storage has to be managed by EVMS for clustering to support it. And there are other things like managing storage technologies like RAID. EVMS is a place to put that all together.
Do we have an idea when that's actually going to be fixed through like a service pack or anything like that?
I don't know that it will be. It might just be bad command line handling in whatever library was used, but it doesn't say anything in the document I have here. And I got to say, I don't like the resolution. So in the meantime, EVMS GUI is the workaround that I would recommend.
Can we update that TID so that it says that now?
I'm going to mention that to the author of the TID and say, you know, rename the server.
I had considered asking him the same question, but I didn't want to put him on the spot and be a jerk. Well done.
Why break the habit of a lifetime?
Ouch.
The last one I have on the TIDs is segmentation fault when trying to make an image with more than 13 hard drives with Novell's MWorks Linux Management version 7. I just looked at it and thought, why are you making an image of 13 hard disks? I mean, seriously, that sounds a little odd. That's a whole rack of disks. Maybe I don't understand the technology, but it's just stood out to me as something unusual.
Maybe they got a really good deal on 10 or 20 gig drives, and they have a partition that spans all 13, and that gets them up to like 130 gigs or something.
And they also had a whole bunch of host bus adapters just sitting around, and they, what?
So whatever is what I'd say to that one. So there's a TID out there. Go enjoy that one.
That is Halloween Novell Open Audio TID right there, isn't it?
Find yourself 14 disk drives and go reproduce that one for kicks. Finally, I'd like to cover a little something I discovered about a week ago.
Now, this is the in place of Randy Goddard's cool tip here. Dave pull off a tip as cool as one of Randy's?
Absolutely.
Aaron,
no
can I get
question.
A drum roll or something?
Sure, that was a drum roll. I read Fresh Meat regularly. Fresh Meat's a website that publishes updates on open source projects. So you go out there, and although there are thousands upon thousands of open source projects, you get daily updates on what's changed on the ones that have had a change. I read it every day looking for things that are of interest, and most days there's nothing there. But when there is, they're often gems. This one I thought was fabulous when I saw it. Xming. If you're Scottish, that one is going to make you laugh.
That's Xming?
That is correct. Xming. And it's an X server for Windows. Doesn't depend on Cygwin, doesn't need the Cygwin DLL, but it'll run as an X server on your Windows desktop, which means you can SSH with PuTTY, for example, into a Linux box, start YAST, and be running YAST as a floating window on your Windows desktop. It just looks great.
So it looks as if it's a native app then, right?
It looks like a native app. It even has the native Windows decorations.
Oh,
the
that's
title
cool.
Bar decorations.
Does it really? Wow.
It is absolutely beautiful to see.
So it's even better than like a Citrix-hosted app or something in a way because it looks so seamless. Well, I guess Citrix
right.
has that now too, don't they? So
yeah, but you're not paying two or three licenses for that.
Absolutely. Yeah, so that's pretty cool.
I think it's great. And VNC would be the thing I would imagine most people would be using to get this kind of functionality. But I had an example that I'm going to provide you guys a picture of it. But I had an example where I had Firefox for Linux and Firefox for Windows open on the same Windows desktop both of them with a menu open. On the Windows one, it was a tools menu where you could see options at the bottom. On the Linux one, it was the edit menu where you could see preferences on the bottom. Two different versions of Firefox on the same Windows desktop. It just looks great.
So if you have enough bandwidth to get the X feed over the net, but you don't have enough bandwidth to download files really fast, or you don't want to be working on the local machine that you're on, if you use something like this, you can work off your remote Linux machine and browse the web, download files right to your remote machine.
Absolutely.
And it's all going to look like it's happening locally, but it's actually happening on the distant machine.
And that's one thing you got to be careful of, because you can have four or five versions of Yast running on the same desktop, and they're all for different hosts. I've actually already used this to work with customers who've had problems running one thing or another, or configuring one thing or another. I've had them let me get an SSH session or provide one out to me. I do a tunnel through that SSH session and then run X applications like Yast on my desktop working on their host. It's just wonderful. It's so powerful. And you know what? You don't get this kind of technology free for any other platform.
That's very cool. How will we get that out there to people? You're going to write a cool solution for it?
I'm going to write a full and detailed cool solution for it. But I'm going to provide you, Ted, with some information about it and some pictures that you can get out a little quicker, perhaps on a blog.
Great. Okay, so we'll link to that onto my blog and then update the link a little later from my blog to the cool solution once it gets put online.
And that's it for me for this time.
So I guess that's it for news from support. Thanks very much, Dave.
Thank you.
And that's it for news from support. Hope you've enjoyed this episode. Remember, you can review any episode online by going to novell.com/openaudio. And you can rate the episode. You can leave us comments by emailing us, those kind of things. Openaudio@novell.com is our email address. Remember that Novell Open Audio is brought to you from your friends at Novell Users International in conjunction with Novell Incorporated. All of our content is driven by listener requests. That's it for this time. We'll see you next time.